All right, it is great to be with you. I hear that this conference has had Bill Smith not once, but twice. Is that correct?
Yeah.
I don't know that I'm worthy. Bill's a good friend of mine and has been a long time, so that's good to hear. It is great to be with you. Thank you for having me. Already enjoyed meeting several of you and getting dinner with you tonight. I hope, trust, and pray that this weekend will be a blessing to you and that even my teaching might be a part of that. My prayer for this weekend is that you will come to a deeper appreciation of what it means to be a man and, of course, specifically a Christian man. I hope that you will see masculine glory in a new way and see that, well, yes, being a man brings with it certain burdens to carry. There's an honor in doing so. There is a glory in doing so. I hope that you will more fully embrace God's calling on your life to be a good man who is good at being a man. You're going to hear that little phrase, that little expression a lot this weekend. And my aim here this weekend is not really to be super profound or even say anything that you haven't heard before necessarily, but I do want to be encouraging to you. I want to be challenging in all the right kind of ways, and I hope I can be encouraging to you. I've got four talks for you this weekend, and then in many ways, my sermon on Sunday will cap it all off. So this is going to make this first talk a little bit longer, but I think it'll be helpful if I give you a little overview of where I want to take us this weekend. This first talk is entitled Weak Men, Feminism's War on Masculinity. And we're going to look at the crisis in masculinity. Why are men often ashamed of being men? Why is it that so much of society, including much of the church, has made it very hard for men to be men? We're going to look at ways that culture has attacked masculinity and God's design for the sexes. And let me say something about that, because I'll use that expression a lot too this weekend, God's design for the sexes. What I mean is the way God created us. God's design, his creational design for men, for the family, for church, for society, could be called patriarchy. Is that a word that you guys use around here, patriarchy? Okay. So the word patriarchy literally means father rule. So just a word about that term, because that term gets abused, I think, sometimes by people who are supportive of it, but, of course, obviously also by people who oppose it and I think don't really understand it, or they understand it and just hate it anyway because they hate God. God, of course, is the ultimate patriarch. Patriarchy is the framework within which God designed men and women to live and thrive. There are deep creational differences between men and women that reflect God's design. You could say reality is patriarchal, starting with God himself. The Trinity is the ultimate patriarch. But God has built a reflection of that. He's built an image of that into the creation. To respect reality means to recognize that God made men and women different by design. And we have to understand what those differences are. Of course, we live in a fallen world, which means that people have rebelled against God's design. And we need to understand that the predominant form that rebellion takes in our culture today is feminism. And so you could say in our day, the battle is shaping up into basically a battle between Christian patriarchy and secular feminism. Those are the main players on the battlefield, the main combatants. In our day, we are plagued by weak men and feminist women. And in fact, weak men have allowed feminist women to do their own thing without accountability, which is a big reason why we are in the mess we're in. And when women do not have masculine grounding and covering, things can go really, really wrong. And that's what we're seeing all around us in the world today. So more about that in a few minutes. The second talk then tomorrow is going to be called Strong Men, Fulfilling God's Masculine Design. So if the problem is weak men, the answer is strong men. And you need to understand, God wants you strong. And he shows you in his word what that means. There is a unique and multifaceted masculine strength that God calls us to. We need to pursue that kind of strength. Or really, I would say, as you'll see in the talk tomorrow, strengths plural. Because there are many different kinds of strength that men need to have, rooted in spiritual strength, but manifested in many different ways. The third talk then also tomorrow is entitled Two Weaker Vessels Reversing Polarity in marriage. If the woman is the weaker vessel, as 1 Peter 3 says, that means obviously the man is to be the stronger vessel. So what does that mean? What does that mean for marriage and for attraction and for sex within marriage? What does that mean for our understanding of the husband's headship and the wife's submission? What is the architecture of marriage, the structure that God has built into marriage? What happens when the stronger vessel isn't stronger? And he becomes a weaker vessel himself, so we'll talk about that. And then the fourth talk is going to be putting masculine strength to work with competence and confidence. And this is going to be probably the most practical talk of the week. How do we judge manhood? What criteria do we use to determine that a man is fittingly masculine? What does it mean to be a good man who is good at being a man? What qualities are essential to masculinity? And then Sunday, in my sermon, I'll be preaching on David as churchman. David as churchman, warfare and worship. And while that talk, that sermon will not be specifically on manhood, I think you'll be able to make the connections and see why the church, and even specifically we could say liturgy or worship, must be at the center of a good man's life. Worship is central to our calling as men. The means of grace that God gives to us in the liturgy strengthen us to do what God calls us to do as men. To be a good man, you have to be a faithful churchman, faithful churchman. And David is a great example of that. And by the way, if you're interested in these topics, Kyle mentioned my X account. You could go look there. I've got a whole host of additional material on all of these topics on our website. I've got a blog there. I've got a bunch of other talks. And also, I do a podcast, a relatively new podcast, with the illustrious Bill Smith, called Collars and Calluses. So you can look that up as well if you're interested. So I want to start with a scripture passage. And this is going to be a very unusual place to start a talk for a bunch of men. Very unusual, but you'll see why I do this in a few minutes. This is from 1 Timothy chapter 5. I'm going to start in verse 11, and Paul here is addressing younger widows. He says, "Refuse to enroll younger widows, for when their passions draw them away from Christ, they desire to marry and so incur condemnation for having abandoned their former faith. Besides that, they learn to be idlers, going about from house to house, and not only idlers, but also gossips and busybodies, saying what they should not. I would have younger widows marry, bear children, manage their households, and give the adversary no occasion for slander." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Indeed. So let's start with this question. And I'm going to make an assumption here that's built into the question, but you'll see why I make it by the time we get to the end. Why is modern man so weak? Why is modern Western man, modern Christian man, so effeminate? Why is he so effeminate compared even to men of just a few generations ago? What has produced this this weakness in men? And what has this weakness in men produced in society? Many forces are conspiring together to undermine God's design for manhood and really womanhood too, because the sexes stand or fall together. If men are failing in their masculine calling, it means inevitably that women are failing in their feminine calling. The sexes win or lose together. We shouldn't really so much talk about a war between the sexes so much as a war on the sexes. Because the sex, if you have a war between the sexes, that doesn't really make much sense, because men can't win without women also winning and vice versa. The feminist movement is at the heart of this problem. And remember, when I use that term feminism, that's not just a label that we apply to certain women. There are plenty of male feminists. Our culture is full of them. And it's important to understand what feminism has done. Feminism aimed to change the status and role of women, but in doing so, it also changed the status and role of men. And men have allowed this to happen. Feminists really, from the beginning, aimed at a unisex or androgynous society where the sexes would be interchangeable, where any sexual differentiation would be minimized. And so that means feminists have sought to emasculate men, to shame their masculine interests and ambitions and drives out of them, to feminize men. And of course, it also aimed to masculinize or harden women, which it has also done. A couple generations ago, a feminist said, we should raise our boys like we raised our girls, and we should raise our girls like we've raised our boys. And that's what many have done, maybe not intentionally, but it's certainly what has happened in the culture. Our culture has raised feminized boys and masculinized girls, boys who are passive and girls who are ambitious. As a generalization, today boys have been made weak and girls have become boss babes. Okay, that's really what so many young women aim at. We've got an epidemic of boys who lack confidence and of girls who are overconfident. We have stolen all kinds of opportunities away from our boys. We've had a kind of, you could say, affirmative action type program for girls that has privileged and subsidized girls at every turn. In short, you could say boys have been pushed down while girls have been propped up. Feminism is a violation of the natural created order. As I said, it's the enemy of the patriarchy, God's creational design. But because it is unnatural, because there's something unnatural about it, it really only arises through artificial means. You've got to rig the system, so to speak, for feminism to work. And so usually that means using the power of the state. And so feminism, and really you could say statism or socialism, feminism and statism or feminism and socialism virtually always go hand in hand. Further, you could say in many ways, we men are victims of our own success. Men are the builders of civilization. Women make people, men build civilization. That's a generalization, but, well, not in the case of women, but, because that's always true in that case. But, you see what I mean? I mean, this is a way of getting at, how the different role that the sexes play. And we men are largely victims of our own success in building civilization. Men are the explorers, the innovators, the inventors, the discoverers of the human race, and we've been so good at it that we have created an incredibly comfortable and prosperous world, a safe world. Okay, you know the saying about the cycle, hard times create strong men create good times create weak men, and here we are in the cycle, weak men create hard times. That seems to be where we are. And so a couple of key things have happened that you need to notice. First, it appears to many that our machines and technology and so forth have made masculinity obsolete. Masculine strength doesn't appear to be as essential to surviving and thriving as it once was. So many men have become soft. For many, it seems that genuine masculinity is archaic and out of place in the modern world. There's no need for masculinity in the modern world. Now, I think that's a myth. I think that's wrong. But it's a widespread myth, a widespread lie, that old-fashioned masculine strength is obsolete in the modern world. And then second, we've created so many jobs that aren't demanding, certainly not physically demanding, that women can do them. Note this. Women did not want to enter the workforce en masse until after the air conditioner was invented. Okay? That doesn't mean women didn't work. Obviously they worked. But it was domestic work primarily. Today we've got lots of desk jobs in nice, comfortable, air-conditioned offices. Women were not clamoring to go off into the mines or go off to sea. You know, in many ways, feminism is a form of rebellion against the created order that could not have happened in a pre-modern economy, at least not in the way that it has. The more comfortable the working world has become, the more women have wanted into it. See, feminism has sold women a lie, really a package of lies. Feminism has told women that in order for their lives to count, they should forsake the home and enter the workplace like men. Okay? That is a lie that women are told constantly today. It's a lie that the culture is constantly preaching to them. Another one of these lies, you know, basically right along with this, women should focus on careers like men. Women should seek financial independence so they won't have to depend on a man. Feminism told women that their life plan and life trajectory should be identical to a man's. And so women have entered into public life and into the workforce en masse, and in doing so, they have remade American institutions in unprecedented ways. And one thing we really need to do to understand this problem, which I want to do for you here in a few minutes, is survey the damage that feminism has wrought. This has been called the Great Feminization. And it is truly one of the most significant and I would say destructive revolutions in history. We still haven't even begun to come fully to terms with just how destructive it's been, how much confusion and chaos and misery it's brought into our culture. It's destroyed manhood and womanhood. It's wrecked motherhood and childhood. It's undermined marriage and family. It's changed the way we do politics and business and education. It's changed the church. And I would say that virtually no church is immune to it. The problem we face is that weak men have let woke women, feminist women, take over almost everything. Almost every area of life is now female coded. And by that, I mean female preferences and sensibilities dominate almost everywhere. Male spaces have been largely eliminated. This conference, as a gathering of men, would be a rare exception to that. But in general, in our culture, male spaces have been completely destroyed. You know, whether it was an office building or a military unit or the pulpit or Augusta National Golf Course, women have entered into these once male spaces. And when women enter into a space that was once an all male space, they change that space. Women no longer under male headship and leadership have gone feral. And they're disproportionately damaging society. Feminism has waged an unrelenting war on reality, on creation, on the divine order. Think about this. If I were to say, you know, boys, as they're growing up, they need to learn to control their sexual and aggressive nature. Okay, if I say boys, as they grow up, they need to learn to control their sexual and aggressive nature, pretty much everybody would agree with that. Pretty much everybody would recognize that for a boy to grow into a man, he's got to learn to control his sexual and aggressive nature. And if a boy is not trained to control his sexual and violent passions, society as a whole will suffer. Undisciplined men create all kinds of social and cultural pathologies. Marriage in particular, historically, has helped to restrain men by placing heavy burdens on them, giving them weighty responsibilities to keep them on track. Mark Driscoll once said, men are like trucks. They drive straighter with a heavy load. And I think that's right. I think that's exactly true. Most crime of a sexual or violent nature is committed by single men, men without much responsibility, without much to anchor them. It would seem there's nothing more important for society than raising boys to be disciplined and self-controlled and responsible men. Okay, that's why fatherlessness is such a crisis. Like if you survey all the pathologies in our culture, all the different things that can go wrong, and you look for some kind of common denominator, what you will find is fatherlessness is right at the heart of it. Boys need a father to train them to rein in their sexual and violent passions. But today, we're seeing that while we were right about men, we were wrong about women. Because the assumption all along was that while undisciplined, untrained men pose a danger to society, women don't. The assumption was women are always angels. And the reality is, no, they're not. They're just as fallen as men. And today, they are even less restrained than men. And so they are doing untold damage to society. When men fail to rule, chaos ensues. Girls need training and discipline every bit as much as boys. As a girl grows into a woman, she has to learn to control her emotional and empathetic nature. And in good societies and healthy societies, that happens largely through male grounding. A man, first her father and then her husband, provides grounding and covering that teaches that girl as she grows into a woman to contain and control her emotional nature. But today, that grounding, that masculine grounding is often missing. Girls grow up with no father, or they grow up with a weak father, an abdicating father. Then they don't get married when they get older. In many cases today, women don't even want to get married. And so women run wild with no accountability. I mean, just think about this. Why do we have public schools and public libraries that push transgenderism and drag queen story hour on little kids? Where does that come from? Who's doing that? 90% plus of elementary school teachers are female. 85% plus of all librarians are female. Cultural Marxism with its oppressor-oppressee dynamic is pushed hard in these contexts. And it's almost always women doing it. It's all emotion and empathy without any masculine restraints or grounding. The 1619 Project, which taught American children to hate their country and which has pushed a really strong and virulent anti-white narrative, was created by a woman. A lot of this stuff started in women's studies departments in big universities, and it just trickled down from there. And of course, most of those professors are women. The teachers' unions that destroyed education during COVID are almost entirely run by women. Female nature is risk averse. And so when it's unrestrained, what do you get? You get safetyism, the idolatry of safety. The transgender stuff in medicine has been largely driven by female physicians. Same with abortion. Women in the medical field push it harder than anyone else, all in the name of women's rights or reproductive justice. Labels like that are used. And you have to understand the logic of abortion for feminists. For feminists, abortion is necessary to maintain and preserve their version of equality and freedom. If women are going to be truly equal with men, they can't be saddled with an unwanted pregnancy. And so abortion is necessary to keep the playing field as level as possible. Otherwise, in the mind of the feminist, she's being punished because nature assigned her the role of carrying the child. A few years ago, 600 medical professionals signed a petition to get pro-life advocates censored. Almost every single signer was female. And you could say, well, really, you're trying to get people censored. Isn't that cancel culture? Well, yes, cancel culture is almost entirely female. It's certainly female-coded, if not female-driven. And, of course, cancel culture is an attack on free speech. I'll say more about that in a few minutes. Now, obviously, this isn't all women any more than all men are violent or sexual predators. But all of this is female emotion and empathy left unchecked. Okay, what we call wokeness. Wokeness is just feminism gone public. Wokeness is the corrosive effect of feminism on public life. When women do not have masculine grounding and covering, the masculine grounding and covering God designed them to have, when they don't get that from husbands and fathers, this is what happens, what we're seeing. Paul gets at something like this in 1 Timothy 5. This is why I read this passage a few minutes ago, 1 Timothy 5. Starting in verse 11, he says he wants younger widows to remarry because he says otherwise their passions, their emotions will draw them away from Christ. He says they'll be idle. They don't remarry. Idle without a home to keep. He says they'll become gossips and busybodies going from house to house, stirring up drama. Okay, I added that part. Paul didn't say that part about the drama, but that's what they're doing. He says they'll say things they shouldn't say. And so Paul says, I want younger widows to marry, build, bear children, manage their households, so they will give the adversary, Satan, no occasion for slander. He says some of these young widows have already strayed after Satan. He wants these younger women to marry precisely so they will have masculine grounding and covering. And he says without it, they are in spiritual danger. See, go back to Genesis chapter 3. When Adam in the garden failed to provide frame, when he failed to provide that grounding and covering for his wife, what happened? She strayed after Satan. Eve was really the first feminist, a woman who threw off male rule. But Adam let it happen. She sinned, but Adam did too. Adam let it happen. He stood by and watched it happen. And so when Paul's writing to Timothy in Ephesus, when he says that these, you know, when he's addressing Timothy in Ephesus, he's talking about these women who lack masculine grounding and covering. Women, we can basically say, who are going woke in its first century version. I think this is what Paul is describing. It's the same kind of thing that happened in the garden. It's the same kind of thing we're seeing happen in the world around us today. Ungrounded, uncovered women go wild. They are not held accountable, and there's no restraint. What keeps the woke moment alive is women who are gossips and busybodies and who let their passions go unchecked. They live by unchecked emotion. You know, in that passage in 1 Timothy 5, you could say that Paul is really describing the proverbial Karen. Okay? I mean, I hate that for anybody named Karen, but I mean, that's kind of what it is. We see this sexually. Women cut off from godly masculine leadership become immodest and promiscuous. lacking godly male attention, they seek ungodly male attention. And so women flaunt their sexuality in the name of freedom and empowerment. But, and I, whenever I see this, you know, you're walking down the street and you see some, you know, young girl who's very modest, I always wonder, where's her dad? Okay? The man in her life who should tell her how foolish this is and put his foot down and put an end to it, either is not there or doesn't do anything. She lacks that masculine grounding and covering. Women have never had as much political and economic power as they do today. About a third of Congress is female now. And if you want to, this is just one example of this. You want to know why our immigration policy is so messed up? It's because the feminist consensus rules. We're not allowed to enforce laws, because those laws might hurt people's feelings, and people's feelings, according to the feminist consensus, people's feelings get prioritized over the rule of law. And that's why we can't fix the problem. Women are positions that would have been unthinkable, even just a couple generations ago, as fire chiefs and police chiefs and in combat roles in the military, though thankfully I think we're bringing that one to an end. But still, we have women in these roles. There are more women than men now in law school and medical school, and that will radically change the legal profession and the medical profession. 4 of the 9 Supreme Court justices are women. 63% of the judges appointed by Biden during his presidency, 63% of the judges appointed to various courts were women. 25 years ago, 70% of psychologists were men. Today, up-and-coming psychologists, like the younger cohort of psychologists, are 80% female. Now, you may not care about that, and I really don't either. I mean, I think the field of psychology is mostly trash. You know, it's mostly all garbage. But it's a great illustration of how when women enter a field like this, they don't leave it the same. What happens when women come to take over a field like this, and they don't have to get above 50% for this to happen, for their sensibilities and preferences to take over. Psychology is now dominated by unchecked feminine sensibilities like empathy. And this has changed the way counseling is done. It's changed the way therapy is done. It's changed the way psychology deals with things like homosexuality and transgenderism. If you go to the DSM, you know, it's the manual, sort of the Bible for psychologists. If you go back far enough, it used to say that homosexuality is an abnormality. Now it's homophobia that is the abnormality. Same kind of things happen with transgenderism. It once was considered a problem, and now it's something that's supposed to be normalized. Therapeutic culture, and we are awash in therapeutic culture is very feminine coded, very much driven by what we could call toxic empathy. Again, I already mentioned this, but the whole transgender phenomenon is largely driven by women. I know multiple cases where the woman, that is the mom, wanted the little child to transition. Dad did not. And when they went to court over this, mom won. Probably because there was a female judge who prioritized feelings over biological facts. You know, there's that old saying, and I've even seen this attributed to Charlie Kirk, I'm not sure, but you know, there's that old saying that if you are an adult transgender, you have a mental illness. If you're a child transgender, your mom has a mental illness. Okay, where's this from? Dads are not the ones doing this. It's moms. Literature is another field dominated by women today. Not because men don't like to read or suddenly lost the ability to write. You know, you might ask, well, why don't we have a Tolkien or a Lewis or a Hemingway around today? Well, we might have one of those around today, but we probably never know it. Because the publishing industry is run by women. 80% of the publishing industry is controlled by women. That means they're the ones making the decisions who and what gets published. They choose mostly female authors, writing books that mostly women like to read. Okay? There may be some great male author out there who's never had his chance because woman after woman in the publishing industry turned him down. Math and engineering are still male-dominated fields, but rather than admitting this is because men and women are different, feminists say this is because of sexism that must be eliminated. That's why we don't have as many female software engineers. It's because of sexism. Does anybody really believe that? It's not because of nature, they say. It's because of sexism. See, this is how the logic of the feminist works. If women lead in some field, that's because, hey, women can do anything. If women don't lead in some field, Well, that's proof we still have sexism and discrimination against women. Real life case of this several years ago, when James Damore, he was a software engineer at Google, when James Damore pointed out in an internal memo to others in the company, when he pointed out that more men than women go into STEM fields, not because of sexism or prejudice, but just because men are wired differently than women and are more inclined to it. So it's not prejudice that accounts for this difference. It's nature that accounts for this difference. That's why men dominate computer engineering and software engineering and related fields. When Damore pointed this out with all kinds of facts on his side, in an internal company memo, the females at Google demanded he be fired. And his female boss did indeed fire him. Okay, those women got their way. No one tried to argue facts with him. It was simply enough that he had offended women. That was enough to get him fired. Or think again about what we call wokeness, which has invaded so much of our politics and taken over our universities. Wokeness is very much driven by feminism. It's a manifestation of feminism in the culture. Now, of course, it's not just women. You've got male feminists who are part of this, too. But wokeness is really just toxic femininity controlling the culture, prioritizing feelings over truth and rationality, putting safety over freedom and risk-taking, prioritizing the collective over the individual, favoring conformity over competition, egalitarianism over hierarchy, socialism over capitalism and free markets. Again, all of these are the result of the great feminization. It's the feminist takeover. Women are twice as likely, okay, so according to recent surveys, women are twice as likely as men to oppose free speech. Why? Because free speech can hurt people's feelings, and women, left to themselves, without that masculine grounding, women left to themselves will often prioritize agreeability and inclusion over truth. Whereas men are much more comfortable being disagreeable, you know, having a disagreement and wanting the truth no matter whose feelings get hurt. You know, it's been said, men argue, women police tone. Okay, I think that's really true. That's why we're not allowed to have arguments in public anymore. Or think about this, in academia, you know, universities are very much female-centric and places that tend to be very hostile to men. Universities should be places and used to be places where you would have debate and argument in the pursuit of truth. But now that women, or feminists in general, largely control the universities, ideas that make people uncomfortable are censored. This is what we've seen happen in our universities. And this is why academia is basically totally worthless today. It's just useless. It's not about the pursuit of truth anymore. It's about protecting people's feelings. If a conservative goes on campus to speak because he's got ideas that are threatening or that will make people, threatening, right? Yeah, that will make people uncomfortable, okay, what happens? He's in big danger, as we saw with Charlie Kirk. Really, that's kind of the ultimate example of this. Conservative speakers aren't safe on campus because they're considered a threat because their ideas make people uncomfortable. Helen Andrews has done a lot of work on this. Helen Andrews summarizes it this way. She's a woman who sees the problem with this. She says, women have an ethic of caring and men have an ethic of justice. Now, that ethic of caring serves women well in the domestic sphere, in the home. Caring is a helpful value. I mean, you want your kids looked after, you know, even the stragglers, you know. You want your kids cared for. But in public life, in politics, in business, in courts of law, all of these traditionally masculine-dominated domains, you want an ethic of justice. That's why those have traditionally been male spaces, male-dominated domains. Think about this. Men tend to be goal-oriented and fact-oriented. In Genesis chapter 1, the creation account, really Genesis chapter 2, you know, you got the creation 6 days in Genesis 1, and then it focuses in on the creation of the man and woman in Genesis chapter 2. In that account in Genesis chapter 2, the man is made from the ground to work the ground and to rule it. And really, this is why men are task-oriented. We're fact-oriented. Men are emotional, too, but we lead with reason. We were made from the ground to take dominion over the ground. The woman was made from the man's side, Women are inherently more relational, more textual, more verbal. Women are rational. They can be, certainly. But they lead with emotion. They process their experiences more emotionally than men. Just think about our respective interests, okay? Men are interested in things, okay? In sports, in guns, in cars, in computers. Women are interested in people and relationships, okay? That goes back to the creation account. The man's made from the ground. He's interested in the things of the earth. The woman's made from the man. She's interested in relationships. That's her primary interest. Helen Andrews points to the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. You remember this a few years ago when Kavanaugh was up for Supreme Court justice? She points to the Kavanaugh hearings as an example of male-female differences. Men observing the hearings were concerned with the facts and noted the total lack of evidence that he was guilty of anything. Certainly there was not sufficient proof to ruin a man's reputation and career. The female response was to say, how can you talk about evidence and facts when a woman is crying? Okay, that's the difference right there. Okay. Cancel culture. Okay, cancel culture is, as Louise Perry has put it, girl culture. Women have a tendency to prioritize kindness over truthfulness. Women want to defend anyone they perceive as being mistreated, regardless of other considerations. And the result is cancel culture. Cancel culture arises from misguided, toxic empathy. Empathy always gives the empathetic person tunnel vision. And that's why empathy never results in justice. In the Bible, judges are forbidden from showing empathy. The law forbids it. It is the law and the facts of the case, not people's feelings, that determine guilt and innocence. Okay, a person controlled by toxic empathy, you know, with a little Marxism mixed in, doesn't need to know the facts of the case to render a verdict. All they need to know is the gender, skin color, and sexual orientation of the participants in the case, and then they can tell you who's guilty and who's innocent. That's toxic empathy. Now, when Helen Andrews points out these kinds of things, she says it's obvious that men and women are different. And when women take over public institutions, those institutions are transformed in very predictable ways according to those differences. And, of course, this is all very bad. It's very bad on all kinds of levels. It's bad for men. It's bad for women. It's bad for society. And yet, to point out that it's bad gets you into all kinds of trouble. Taking women out of the domestic sphere and into the public world has been an unmitigated disaster. Women who lack masculine grounding and covering are a disaster for society. Putting women in positions of ecclesiastical and pastoral leadership is another example of this. Perhaps this is the place where we see most clearly the total disaster this has created. No denomination that has put women in leadership positions has remained orthodox. Obviously, women in the pastorate is contrary to the divine design. It violates the divine law. It's a flagrant rejection of scriptures like 1 Timothy chapter 2. But consider some of the reasons why God prohibits women from church leadership. Obviously, it has to do with the male-female design differences. I'm not going to go into all of that. But just consider this fact. It's not arbitrary. What do leaders in the church have to do? Leaders in the church have to teach truth. They've got to challenge error. They've got to make judgments in church courts and excommunicate the unrepentant, which is the spiritual death penalty. They've got to call out people's sins. These are masculine tasks that are not suited to women. Women in church leadership, even in informal, non-ordained, so-called shepherdess positions, like what you have happening in a lot of PCA churches today, it always, always, always undermines orthodox doctrine. In a sense, what you're doing when you put a woman in a pastoral position is you're putting a non-combatant on the front line, and you're no longer capable of fighting error. When women are in positions of leadership in the church, they don't correct errors in others, because that would hurt their feelings. But it's also very hard for men to correct that woman in a position of leadership, in some kind of public position, if she's in error. When a woman is in leadership and she is in error, any man who corrects her risks being seen as mean, being seen as unkind. He risks being accused of sexism. Now, when Helen Andrews assesses the feminization of culture, the feminization of politics and business and academia and so forth, she says all we have to do to solve the problem is eliminate policies that favor women over men. She says the invasion of women into public life is largely due to artificial age. You know, we sort of put our thumb on the scale, tipping everything in the favor of women. You know, so women get more scholarship opportunities and there are hiring quotas. So a certain number of women have to be hired. You've got all these kinds of these advantages that are given to women. You know, their jobs and promotions and opportunities that otherwise women would not get, that they get because of this artificial situation that we have created. Jobs are created just, you know, for women to fill a quota, just to fill a quota. They get school slots, they get jobs and so forth, not because of their qualifications, but because schools and businesses want to avoid lawsuits and meet quotas. Now, this is why HR departments, you know, the bane of the modern workplace, this is why HR departments exist. HR departments exist, perhaps in part to create jobs for women, but also to enforce feminine norms on everyone. If a work environment is not explicitly welcoming to women, it is a lawsuit waiting to happen. Every interaction in the workplace is governed according to feminine feelings and sensibilities. And so men can't be men when HR is watching. Men have to emasculate themselves all too often to get by in the corporate world today. Otherwise, they risk getting fired or sued. We've seen what female leadership did to brands like Cracker Barrel and Bud Light. And rather than conclude that the failures of these brands mean that the women really messed up, instead it's used as proof that society is still infected by toxic masculinity. You know, we haven't arrived at the goal yet. The other issue that Andrews points to is all of the economic factors from inflation to immigration and so on that makes many families think they need two incomes in order to survive at, you know, say a basic middle class level. Change the policies, Andrews says, and nature will revert back to its factory settings. You know, Andrews thinks if we just do away with DEI and these other kinds of things, everything will snap back into shape. I think she's right, we should do away with those things. But I'm not convinced that's all we need to do. I don't think that's sufficient. I also think we actually have to train girls and women to control their emotional and empathetic natures, the same way we train boys to control their sexual desires and their aggressive tendencies. And this can only happen if we restore masculine frame in society, the grounding and covering of a man. Without a strong man providing strong masculine leadership, this rolling revolution that is feminism will continue. And so I think the big question here really is this: how did we let this happen? Why did we let this happen? And by we, I mean men. How and why did we men allow this to happen? Here's what we have to grapple with at a society-wide level. Modern Western man, modern American man, modern Christian man is weak. Weak like Adam in the garden. He is weak, too weak to tell women no, too weak to restrain fallen and toxic femininity, too weak to hold women accountable, too weak to call out typical feminine sins the way the Bible does regularly. I put it this way. Feminism was a civilization-wide test for men that men failed. We didn't have to let it happen, but we did. Remember, there's that scene in Lord of the Rings when Elrond says men are weak. The same thing could be said of modern Western man. Modern Western man is weak. We have allowed ourselves to be emasculated. This weakness is not primarily physical. So I'm not just talking here about something like falling testosterone levels, which if that's true, that should greatly concern us. But that's not the main thing here. Modern Western man is spiritually weak. And this spiritual weakness is seen in his inability to shepherd and lead his women. And by his women, I mean his wife and his daughters. And in saying this, I'm not at all discounting the sins of women. Women are responsible for their own sins. And I pointed out a bunch of those sins. Women do often rebel. They sin. They're responsible for their rejection of God's design. Some women refuse to submit to even a good father and a good husband. That happens. But this is the key point. Women were made to live under the headship of a man. First her father and then her husband. And of course you could say also the male elders of her church and normally a male civil magistrate. But when you have so many women who have gone feral, it indicates a deeper problem, not just with women, but with men. What do women do when male leadership is weak? I'll tell you this, they don't create a wonderful civilization. Okay, that's kind of the myth that if women were just in charge, it'd be all sunshine and rainbows. Okay, well, the rainbow part, yeah, maybe, in a different sense. Isaiah 3 says, when women rule over you, it is a curse. Okay? When women rule, they don't create some kind of great civilization. Instead, what they do is abort 60 million babies. They vote Marxists into office. They divorce their husbands. 70% of all divorces are initiated by women. They sleep around and become single mothers. They become immodest and promiscuous. Women can't be real, proper, truly feminine women without strong, masculine leadership. And that has been lacking. That strong, masculine leadership has been lacking for several generations now. Why do I say men are weak? Well, start with pastors, okay? Not your pastor, okay, Kyle, but pastors in general. Okay, how often do pastors confront women's sins? Okay, trust your pastor does, but many pastors won't. In fact, the vast majority won't. Those same pastors have no problem confronting men's sins, but they're afraid to confront women's sins because they're afraid of upsetting women. I cannot tell you how many pastors are afraid of offending women. Scripture addresses specific, you know, you could say gender-specific sins, just as it calls us to gender-specific virtues and tasks, okay? But pastors often fail to do this. I can tell you, as a pastor, I have had times when I have pointed out the sins of women in a sermon from the pulpit, and I've had not just women, but men come and tell me that I shouldn't do that because it will hurt women's feelings. I'll say more about that in just a minute. Proverbs has a lot to say about the particular sins women are prone to, like immodesty and nagging. Paul addresses the sins that women are especially prone to, like gossip and refusing to submit to their husbands. But do pastors speak to this sin, these sins? Many pastors are weak and won't do it. Here's another one. Husbands. A lot of husbands are afraid of their wives. They are particularly afraid of their wives' emotions. Now, most men will admit that, okay? But it's a reality. Psalm 128 describes the household that fulfills God's design. And it's a beautiful picture. If you read or sing Psalm 128, the man is at the head of his table. His wife is a fruitful vine in the heart of the house. His children are like olive plants gathered around his table. But you know how that psalm begins? Blessed is the man who fears the Lord. All of this, this embodiment of wisdom seen in his family, all of this flows out of fearing the Lord. Fear of the Lord, not fear of wife, is the key. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Fear of wife is the beginning of folly. But the reality is, many men have a very hard time standing up to women, especially their own wives. Some men would rather face an oncoming opposing army of, you know, hundreds of other soldiers rather than to face their wife or have to stand up to their wife. Some men can tell anyone else no except for their wives. They can confront anyone except for their own wife. I think the feminizing revolution of the last 100 years is perhaps the single most significant shift in our culture. It has changed more and it explains more of what has gone wrong than anything else. It explains what we see all around us. And while here I've mainly looked at it at a cultural level, the reality is what has happened at the cultural level, you could say a culture-wide scale, is really just a magnification of what has happened in our homes. Men have been weak in the culture because they've been weak at home. What makes so many Christian men weak leaders in their homes? Here's a few other things to think about. Some men are white knights. Okay, you know what white knighting is? White, you know, a white knight is a simp. Okay, that man's main concern is to ingratiate himself to a woman. And so if someone, this is what I was talking about before just a minute ago when I preached a sermon that addresses the sins of women. If someone criticizes a woman, the white knight will rush to her rescue because he wants to protect that woman. He derives value from protecting any woman from corruption or from criticism. He wants to rescue the damsel in distress from anyone who might hold a woman accountable. Okay? And he does all of this, not because it's something that God commands him to do, but because he wants a woman's approval. He wants to be seen as a good guy by all the ladies. But while white knighting, but what we have to understand is that white knighting is a perversion of the man's innate desire to protect women. That's really not what protecting women looks like. Some of you may know Michael Foster. few years ago, Michael Foster put out a tweet or whatever they're called now, where he said that men should be very careful about marrying single moms. He didn't say don't do it. He just said be careful about it. You know, figure out why she's single. Don't just think, here's a woman in trouble, I can rescue her. Here's a woman in need, I can provide for her. You know, he just made the point, vet her carefully. Figure out what her story is. Make sure that you're hearing the truth. And he got lambasted for that by the white knights, who basically said, how dare you? You know, how dare you question a woman's story? Or think about this, when it comes to abortion, you will often hear from pro-life people that in abortion, there are two victims, the baby and the woman. Now, maybe that's true if, you know, if somebody puts a gun to a woman's head and says, you must get an abortion, and she's pressured into it. Yes, I would consider her a victim in that case. But the reality is that's not how most abortions happen in our culture today. Many women want to be promiscuous, and yet they don't want to be mothers. They want sex without consequences. Abortion is just part of a promiscuous lifestyle. You've got some women today who will shout their abortion. They are proud of their abortions. But see, for the white knight, the woman is always, always innocent. I mean, except for a little fringe, almost everybody in the pro-life movement is unwilling to say that abortion, in principle, should be criminalized, not just for the doctor who performs it, but also for the pregnant woman who procures it. That she should be treated as an accomplice to murder by the law. The pro-life movement won't say that. Now, it was really interesting. A few years ago, Trump kind of stumbled into saying this. Almost accident, like just the logic of it. You know, just in an interview, just, you know, how Trump is. Just kind of stuff gets spilled out. And the pro-life movement immediately condemned him for it. That's not pro-life. Okay, we would never say the woman is committing a sin, much less a crime, by getting abortion. She's really just another victim. That's not the case. A woman who procures an abortion, most of the time, is committing murder. Most of the time, she knows exactly what she's doing, and she does it anyway. She's not another victim. Same kind of thing with divorce. Women initiate 70% plus of divorces. Now, obviously, in at least some percentage of these cases, they have grounds. But many times, they don't. And when a woman seeks to get a divorce without grounds, you are not allowed to criticize her. Even if she says she's doing it just because she got bored, or she's selfish, or she just thinks the grass is greener on the other side of the fence. I mean, I've seen several cases, even in conservative Christian churches. I know a guy going through this right now, in a conservative Reformed church, where his wife is leaving him for no reason whatsoever, biblically speaking, no grounds whatsoever. And the church is doing nothing. They do not challenge her. They do not call her to repent. They have not done anything to try to stop her. Okay? What you have in a situation like that is really a session of white knights who think a woman can do no wrong. And it's got to be entirely they just assume it's got to be entirely the husband's fault. And so, yeah, that's what she wants. She can do it. Nobody can stop her. Nobody can criticize her for it. I mean, we've seen the same kind of thing play out in other ways in the culture. If a woman wants to go into a combat role in the military, she can't be criticized for that. It's somehow the failure of men, because men are not willing to protect the nation. That's why this woman wants to go into a combat role in the military. That's just not true. We have enough men to protect the nation, enough men who are willing to do so. But even John Piper, you know, put it this way. You know, he said that when a woman goes into military service, looking for a combat role, that's just because men have failed to be protectors. I'm like, no, it's not. We have enough men here too who are willing to do the protecting. Okay? But we coddle women. We're not willing to tell them no. We're not willing to draw a line. We reorganize our entire military to suit the preferences of a tiny handful of women. The white knighting has to end. White knighting is weakness. Whether it's at home or in the culture, the white knighting has to end. And the white knighting really is implicitly Marxist. It works in terms of that same oppressor-oppressee dynamic that Marxism operates with. And what this means is, it's kind of an oddity, but white knights and feminists end up in the exact same place. Even though white knights are usually complementarian, or sometimes might even describe themselves as patriarchalists, they end up in the exact same place, saying that men are 100% to blame for everything that goes wrong, and women are 0% to blame. Men who are primarily concerned with what women think, I would just tell you this as a general rule, women who are primarily concerned with what women think of them cannot be trusted. Men who live for female approval are trapped not by the fear of man, as we usually talk about, but by the fear of woman, and they are fools. What about this one? Men who buy into happy wife, happy life as a slogan for marriage, or servant leadership. Okay, men controlled by these slogans are almost certainly controlled by the fear of women. They are weak men. Think about the logic of that slogan, happy wife, happy life. The idea is that if a husband always gives his wife her way, she'll be happy. And who knows, she might even reciprocate. Now, I would say men should definitely seek to please their wives in a very basic way, but they should do so under God as a way of ultimately pleasing God. And they should do so from a position of strength, not of desperation. Happy wife, happy life all too often means seeking to please a woman from a position of weakness. Happy wife, happy life means she does what she wants and you do what she wants also. That's what it tends to mean. Happy wife, happy life is really woman worship. It's just another form of fear of woman. It's womanolatry. It's really the original sin of Adam in the garden. Or servant leadership. The servant leadership model runs into the same kind of problems. The servant leadership model, the way it usually plays out, means that a man thinks he's serving his wife by giving her what she wants, letting her make the decisions, coddling her emotions. Now, what servant leadership should mean is that you serve by leading. And leading your wife, including leading her emotions, is then a gift that you give to her out of your strength. It's an act of service to lead her. And sometimes you serve her and lead her by telling her no or by confronting her sin. But in practice, what servant leadership all too often means is really an inversion of the biblical pattern. It inverts the biblical pattern of marriage. It makes the wife the leader, and the husband becomes her submissive helper. Yes, dear. Yes, dear. Yes, dear. Servant leadership means that the husband can only lead his wife in the way she permits him to lead. Her feelings become the standard by which his leadership is measured. Not scripture, but her feelings become the standard. And it's not really leadership at all. Now, obviously, husbands should consult with their wives. I'll talk about that more tomorrow. Your wife is your own personal lady wisdom. But you are the head. You have authority and responsibility over your household. It's so important to understand all of these things really are a very old phenomenon. They trace all the way back to our first father, Adam, the original simp, the original servant leader, the original white knight, the original happy wife, happy life guy. What does he do in Genesis 3? Instead of leading his wife, he lets his wife do what she wants and make her own decisions. You know, I kind of think of Adam in the garden as she's having the conversation with the snake and he's telling himself, you know, if my wife wants to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, who am I to tell her otherwise? I want my wife happy. I want my wife to get her way. I want her to let her make her own decisions. It's a disaster. A weak man lets the serpent into his garden. He lets the serpent whisper in his wife's ear. You know, he's not going to be one of those men with toxic masculinity who exerts authority over his wife. No, he's a nice guy. He's a good guy. Okay, we might tell ourselves that, but that's a lie. There's an Adam in every one of us. An Adam in every one of us who fears his wife more than God. You have to kill that inner Adam. You have to kill that inner simp. You have to kill that inner beta. Women who are not led by their husbands cause problems. Okay, we see that in society. We see that in the home. I've seen it in the church. Women who are not ruled by their husbands are unhappy. And I can tell you as a pastor, the biggest troublemakers in the church are not alpha males. That's what everybody thinks. Biggest troublemakers in the church are not the alpha males, but women who are married to beta males. These women are married to betas, to weak leaders. And so they're insecure about their husband's leadership, which makes them anxious. They then project that anxiety and insecurity onto all males in position of leadership. And they become anxious about male leadership in general. Causes all kinds of problems in the church. And I'll tell you this, if elders constantly defer to those women become even more insecure. In a way, what they're begging for is for a man to stand up to them and to lead them. Because women were made to live under strong male leadership, and when it is lacking, their most negative qualities get accentuated. Their most negative qualities run free, unfettered, unchecked. Without male leadership, all constraints on the worst aspects of fallen female nature are removed. We see it in the family, we see it in the church, we see it in the culture. Women must be held accountable for their sins, and it falls to men to do so. Now, I don't mean every man with every woman, but I mean each man with his wife or with his daughters. We know we need to do this with one another, we need to do it with our sons. But we have to do it with the females in our lives as well. Women need masculine guidance and sheltering and grounding and covering. Weak men fail to do these things. They fail to lead women. They do not provide that masculine grounding and covering. And we see the result all around us. And so what do we need? We've got a culture filled with weak men. What do we need? We need strong men. And that's really tomorrow's talk. And what we're going to see is that grace does not destroy nature. Grace does not destroy masculinity. Grace restores masculinity. It restores masculine purpose, drive, and strength. And that's what God calls us to. Let me close this in prayer. Father, we do thank you for this time we've had together. We thank you that you are a good and gracious God, and that your wise design can be seen in the way that you made us and in the way that you call us to live in your scripture. And yet, Father, we know too that we have in many ways abandoned this design, and we have not been faithful to you or true to that design. And so I pray that you would help us as men, that you would strengthen us, that we might lead the women in our lives who are entrusted to our covenantal care, and that this might be for the good of our homes and our church and our society. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. Thank you all. Do you want me to take questions?
Yeah. Do you mind?
Well, I was hoping to talk long enough I wouldn't have to.
Do 10 minutes, and then we'll cut it off. Anybody has questions for after us?
Yeah.
Do you think a part of the problem of feminism is preaching the feminine Jesus?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The whole Jesus meek and mild thing. I think one of the big reasons we get masculinity wrong is because we get Jesus wrong. And what happens is we just pick out those parts of Jesus' actions or teaching that are really soft that fit with the sensibilities of a feminized culture. Okay, so, you know, it's all cross, no resurrection. It's all Jesus with the woman at the well, and it's not Jesus getting out a whip and flipping over tables. Okay, so there's that. And I would say it's even more than that. You know, there are some people who think, well, wasn't Jesus a pacifist? I'm like, no. Jesus said in Matthew 24 that he was going to level Jerusalem and the temple to the ground and not leave one stone on top of another. And when it happened, Jesus did that. Now, he used the Romans to do it, but Jesus did that. In the book of Revelation, Jesus rides out, going forth conquering and to conquer on a white stallion with a sword coming forth from his mouth. Jesus is a warrior. So I think our whole picture of Jesus is very much skewed and flawed, and I think that's a big part of the problem that we have with these kinds of issues. We get masculinity wrong because we get everybody would agree Jesus has got to be the model for masculinity. Okay, insofar as Jesus is an example that can be imitated. But we get that example wrong, what it really means. Jesus is not just Jesus meek and mild. I mean, there is that, and that's a part of masculinity too. But Jesus is also a warrior. He's a fighter. He is not just tender, he's also tough. We've got to have a holistic picture of Jesus, and we often don't have that. So, yeah, that's a great question. What else?
And thinking about how we fix this for the next generation, for our kids, you mentioned, I think about education, you mentioned 90% of teachers are women, and I think 85% of librarians maybe are women too. Even in our own church, we started a school, and I don't know the percentage, but I assume that the numbers for our own church are over 80% teachers. And we have a fair amount of good Christian private schools in the area, and it's probably true for them as well. So So what would your, I guess, how would you address that?
What I would,
a teacher's salary, you can't provide.
Right. What I would say is that women who have the kind of masculine grounding and covering I'm talking about can appreciate masculinity enough to understand what it is, and it's not the same problem. It's not just women do this, but it's women who are unchecked and who aren't tethered in some way to masculinity and therefore don't appreciate masculinity. I mean, the reality is most of these women in public schools and public libraries and so forth despise masculinity. So it's not just having women present there, but it's a woman who has been cut off from a faithful and wise and strong masculine presence in her life. Okay, because women can do, I mean, like, there are a lot of, moms with boys who do a great job with their boys, and teachers, female teachers in a school context who can do a great job with boys. But the ones who do are the ones who have had that kind of masculine presence in their lives and who appreciate it rather than despise it. So I think that makes all the difference. So I think it'd be really weird to have a bunch of men teaching, in that context. So it's not just the raw number, but it's the kind of women that are there. These are women who don't have an appreciation for masculinity and who therefore, privilege, things that are female coded. So, I grew up going to public school for the most part and, I can look back now and even see it. We were kind of like, when I graduated, that was like from elementary school, like we were about the last ones to get dodgeball. Okay. And it was because of the female sensibilities taking over. Somebody might get hurt. Well, like a woman who understands masculinity would say, well, that's okay. They'll live. It's better to get hurt playing dodgeball than, never get to do anything. I remember Doug Wilson's got that line where he says that, if a mom won't let her son climb a tree because he might break an arm, it'd be better for him to climb the tree and break both arms, and I always think back to, my son broke both of his arms twice growing up, so we can check that box, but there's a kind of woman who does appreciate this, but in our culture, we don't have very many of those kind of women. Okay, well. That's true.
So kind of getting, I think, what Adam was talking about, how would you go about addressing that at our school, where right now it's maybe not as big of a deal, because I think a lot of the kids are a lot younger, but just as you progress that forward, what would be some possible solutions?
Yeah, well, so think about it in terms of the family. When a child is really small, whether it's a boy or girl, that child is going to have a much tighter bond with mom than with dad. And in those early years of life, mom is primarily the one, who's keeping the child alive, nurturing the child, doing all these things with the child. And dad is involved and ought to be involved, but it's not the same kind of thing. But as that child gets older, and this is really true of sons and daughters, in a lot of ways, the dad then becomes more important, the more important figure. Important may not be the right word to use, but becomes primary in a certain kind of way, in preparing, his child to launch out into the world. And that looks very different for daughters than it does for sons. But there is that kind of transition that takes place at a certain point when a child is growing up. And so I would say that there are ways to, capture that in the context of a school. As you get into the upper grades, if at all possible, find a way to fund more male teachers who can be that masculine presence. There's also all kinds of ways that you can differentiate the sexes within a classroom. I mean, I think one thing that would be great, like my church is starting a school too, and if somebody just handed me $1 billion and said, here, go start a school, like I'd start distinct boys and girls schools and have opportunities for them to come together, but educate them separately, because I think there's a lot of advantages to that. Nobody's going to hand me $1 billion unless one of you wants to. So I can't afford to do that. But there are still things that you can do. There are things that you can do to highlight the differences. Like, so here are some examples of things I've seen in, in a Christian school context. When somebody, if you're going to open the class in prayer, call on boys to pray, not girls. Okay? Because that's a leadership role that you want to have a boy, you want to have a boy doing that. When class is over, let the girls all go out first. You know, have the boys stand, let all the girls go out, and then after the girls are, you know, it's just kind of an act of chivalry, then the boys go out. You know, there are all kinds of things like that that you can do. To highlight those sexual differences. If you've got to do set up and take down for something, move tables and chairs around, that kind of thing, that's a boy's job, not a girl's job, you know, because we expect that of our boys. So there are a lot of things like that that you can do. And then, of course, you can get into things like sports and that kind of thing. Like, this is one of the areas where egalitarianism has, I think, just killed us, is we have come to the point where even a lot of conservatives think that girls' sports play the same role for girls that boys' sports play for boys. That's not true. Sports is warfare by other means. And sports have always played a role in the development of masculinity, and it does not play that role in the development of femininity. Like, I always say to dads with daughters who are going to play a sport, I'm like, well, okay, you can, you know, she can play that sport, but she has to have a bow in her hair every time she plays. Something's going to highlight her femininity. And it should not be your goal to be teaching her constantly how to be tough and aggressive, because that's just not going to serve her well. Whereas for a boy, I mean, you want that. You know, you want him to learn assertiveness and the right kind of aggressiveness and competition and that kind of thing. So sports are going to play a very different role. So there's a lot of things like that that within the context of a school, I think you can highlight the differences between boys and girls. And, you know, again, if possible, as the kids get older, you give them more of a masculine presence, you know, in the classroom or in whatever way you can. So, yeah. Anything else?
Short that you just kind of spark my mind, but do you think that, like, so I think about, like, last year when C.R. Riley was here, he talked about the economy of the home. He talked about how we used to, everything used to be in the home, everybody lived in the home together, and then the Industrial Revolution happens, now the men are out of the home. Do you think that that's played into what we see today?
Yes, I mean, and I've read to Wiley and talked to Wiley about that issue, and I do think there's a lot of truth to that characterization. I don't think it's totally true. There were lots of jobs where men did go out from the home where women did not. And there was also, even when all of the labor was sort of contained in, like, say, a family farm or a family business, there still was typically a very strong and defined sexual division of labor. Men do these jobs, women do these jobs. And so it was, you know, that was very clear. I do think the Industrial Revolution has presented all kinds of challenges to us. When it comes to these things. At the same time, I don't want to give it up. You know, I like my hot running water and, you know, toilets that flush and that. I mean, yeah, I think the Industrial Revolution's given us a lot of really good things and has saved a lot of people from poverty and starvation and whatnot. So I think it's overall a good thing. But there are certain challenges that come, to adapting, the biblical pattern for the household to new conditions. And I actually think that for a while after the Industrial Revolution, we actually did that okay. Because the Industrial Revolution and the rise of feminism don't completely coincide. I mean, feminism is really, in terms of being culturally significant, is really a good bit later. So I think they're distinguishable. So we should ask questions about how the Industrial Revolution has reshaped the household and what new challenges it presents. I mean, the thing is, now we've moved on from the Industrial Revolution to the Technological Revolution. So we've now got a whole different set of questions to ask in light of that. So we should ask those questions and ask what kind of, you know, what are the pros and cons of this, and what kind of challenges does it present for those who want to, you know, for us as Christians, as we seek to maintain a biblical pattern of the household and go with the grain of creation. You know, the kind of thing I mentioned here tonight is, like, you know, do our machines and technology make masculine strength obsolete? The answer is absolutely not. I mean, whether you have a job lifting heavy stuff and doing dangerous things outside, or you work inside with a, you know, in an air-conditioned office, the world still needs your masculinity. Your home and your church still need your masculinity. Like, masculinity does not, the significance of it doesn't go away just because the industry and technology change. Okay, there's another question back here somewhere.
I don't know if I was following the train of thought, but you mentioned that Adam had, you know, said the word was maybe beta or whatever, but he, you know, observed and whispered in his ears and that. But as, you know, the get. So, and Adam was made in God's image. So, I mean, like, how did that kind of, is that kind of inherent nature also, like,
well, so I think if I understand what you're getting at, what I would say is that the entrance of sin into the world was a process that culminated with the act. Okay, but think about this: as soon as the serpent lied, you know, so Adam is told even before the woman is created to guard and cultivate the garden. Okay, so protect the garden and provide from the garden. You know, guard and cultivate. So he should have known that there was going to be an intruder at some point. Why would God say to guard it if there's not? So he should have been ready. He should have been battle ready, you know, at any moment, for this intruder. When the intruder shows up, and he should have known or did know and ignored the fact that this is the intruder. As soon as the serpent contradicts God's word, he should have said, this is the intruder. This is what I'm supposed to guard, the garden, and therefore the bride, because the bride is really the garden come to life. This is what he's got to guard the garden and the woman from. And so what should he have done at that moment? He should have put himself between the woman and the serpent, and he should have crushed the serpent's head. The serpent's lying, the serpent's contradicting God's word, the serpent's got to be destroyed. That's what he should have done in that moment. Instead, he stands by and watches and allows this to unfold. So there are lots of different ways you can describe that first act of sin, what we might call the original sin. In one sense, you can say all sins are contained in that first sin. You know, there's pride there. There's idolatry. There's spiritual adultery. There's theft. You know, they're taking fruit that doesn't belong to them. All sins are contained in that first sin. But I would say one way to look at it is the original sin is the sin of effeminacy. Adam failed to be a man. He failed to man up. The original sin was Adam's failure to exert holy violence when a situation called for it. And instead he passively stood by, abdicated, watched all of this happen. And so it's really that effeminacy of Adam in that moment that I'm trying to capture. Okay? That's what I'm really trying to get at. So Adam should have immediately put himself between the woman and the serpent and gone to battle with the serpent and crushed the serpent's head in order to guard the garden and guard his wife. That's what he should have done.